Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us and welcome to the new year. This is our first show in a couple weeks. We'll be talking about Sean Parnell, Governor of Alaska, meets with the major executives of leading oil companies here in Anchorage. Bill Sheffield is out as port director, and why is that? A Russian tanker is on its way to Nome to relieve the people of Nome who are short on fuel, but it had to turn back and will eventually get there, it looks like, but it may take a little while. And New Year's Eve in Anchorage. We had some criminal activity. We also had a lot of fireworks, and I noticed myself going downtown, there was a significant amount of broken glass. Joining us tonight are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Sean Dugan of Channel 11, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Steve McDonald, Governor Parnell met with the owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, some of the potential builders of a gas line, and it was a very unusual meeting to have, first of all, to have the leaders of BP, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips in the same room, and they were right here in Anchorage.
Yeah, and they seemed unified, too, at least from what we could tell on the surface, and that was really strange. So you've got the big three, and then you had the governor, and this, if for people who want to see a natural gas pipeline built, this is a good sign. In October, Governor Parnell comes out and says, we'd really like to see the pipeline, or we should really consider seeing the pipeline instead of going across Canada into lower 48 markets. We should see a pipeline actually go to port in Anchorage or Valdez or whatever, but someplace here in Alaska, and then ship liquefied natural gas to Asian markets. That's where the market is. That's where the price is highest. And he seems to have struck a nerve with that. Members of the legislature all got on board, it seemed, and now you've got Exxon, BP, ConocoPhillips having this two-hour meeting yesterday and then going on and having another briefing afterwards and coming out and at least some of the two of the big three talked to the media and told folks what it's about. It's still very early yet. Nothing's been really decided. But this is the scenario that most people felt had to happen in order for a pipeline to get built. The three big producers would have to get on board together.
And Parnell called the meeting. I assume this is good politics for him.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, absolutely. He's the one that seemed to strike that spark back when he said we should go to Tidewater and we should think about shipping to Asia. And since then, there's been some momentum that's been obviously building up. And it hasn't gone any further than the talking stages, as far as we know. But he certainly has gotten something rolling here with that comment.
Sean, what did Channel 11's reporters learn, and what does this mean for TransCanada and the AGEA process?
Well, in a word or a couple of words, who knows, I guess, what it means for AGEA and TransCanada. Now, this is technically still under the AGEA plan, but this, if you remember at the time, this was kind of put in as an afterthought with some pressure the LNG line when the state was looking, and former Governor Palin were looking at the main line down to the lower 48. So this is within the AGEA framework. This is something people like Jim Whitaker with the Port Authority and Bill Walker, former Governor Walter Hickel, had said would be the line that would get built, and it seems maybe they were had a little clearer crystal ball than some others. But I think for me the big shift is going from the national security issue of we need to get our gas to the lower 48. To now we need to do this. If Alaska wants this gas, it's going to Asia. So this has become less of a national conversation, I think, more of a conversation about what can Alaska do for itself. And I think it's a major policy shift to say that the future for Alaska's gas is now in Asia instead of the lower 48, where they're finding gas, it seems, everywhere they look.
I'm sorry, Jill, but I beg your pardon.
I was just going to jump in. I mean, I think it's no small accident that this meeting is coming on the heels of, right in advance of the legislative session when oil taxes are expected to come back up again. And I think also you have to look at Parnell's potential future political aspirations, not just his term as governor, but if he wants to move up and onward, certainly getting these three on board, talking together, getting a workable plan in place and making that happen so everybody feels happy would be a huge win. I think in our office in particular, there is a desire to see a conversation take place about the sincerity of the promises and pledges that we're hearing and whether they can really prove that if an oil tax climate were to shift, that they will actually make these investments, that this line and this alliance among these large titans and this governor who has politically a lot to gain will actually yield results, or if it's a lot of talk at this point.
Right.
And we've had a lot of talk building up to this for years.
Yeah. And Steve, they didn't publicly discuss the oil tax regimen, the changes the companies and the governor want in taxes, but that had to be. That's in the room, that's in the air, it's in the ether hovering over them.
That's the 800-pound gorilla in the corner
of the room.
I was going
to leave him out, but there you go.
Yeah, but absolutely. And governor's on board saying he supports HB 110. That's going to be the issue in the upcoming legislative session. The House has already passed 110. They did it last legislative session, so it's going to be before the Senate where it faces an uncertain future. But there's a number of lawmakers who are saying, well, you know, there may be another way to do it, doing this, giving the oil industry what it wants, but maybe it's not under the guise of HB 110. So, yeah, it's there. You wonder if it's a package deal. It's going to be part of it. One of the things, I don't know how this is going to play out, but one of the aspects of the gas line as it now sits in terms of coming down through the interior and then heading out through Canada and lower 48, there's federal money involved in that, right? So I wonder, is the federal government going to pony up money, millions of dollars of taxpayers' money, for us to build a gas line and ship it over to Japan and China?
I did a little research on
that. Now,
as a result of my research, I'll direct that question to Mr. Dugan. And that is, I'm told that, first of all, that they would, if there was a gas line to Tidewater, it would require a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission certificate of some kind, whatever they call it. It would also require the approval of the Department of Energy. And if they wanted all the stimulus, incentives, subsidies under the Pipeline Act of 2004, I believe it is, this would require and to build a separate pipeline to Tidewater to go to Asia, this would require an act of Congress. Mm. So especially that in this environment, it's a very different country now than we were in 2004, and I don't know how popular you get in Washington with subsidies to oil companies, but I think I gave an answer and I was trying to ask a question. I'm embarrassed,
that's all
right. So go right
ahead.
No,
that's quite okay. Probably better answer than I would have given. But, it does, the Washington, D.C. angle that Steve brought up and you talked about is interesting because it kind of takes the wind out of the sails, at least from the federal angle of why do we care now about this gas line? Because it was going to help support the U.S. infrastructure and give us energy security. They have a joint pipeline office. They got a gas line coordinator, Larry Persily, whose office has now been cut. I think that tells you a lot about what you need to know about the future of that. But you're right. It takes an act of Congress for us to export to a foreign country. So we are going to need their help. What's in it for them at this point? But it is highly unusual to get the three CEOs of corporations that large in a room with anybody, a president, a head of state, a governor. So it is significant what it means, whether it's more oil tax or less pipeline. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
The three executives who have been called by at least one wag, the three tenors. Sean, let's stick with you. What does this mean potentially for the proposed bullet line?
Who knows? Again, the bullet line down to Anchorage to help supply the South Central with gas. That was a high priority in last year, and now we're starting to see people claim there's a lot of gas already in Cook Inlet. So if you have this line, this LNG line to Tidewater, do you need a bullet line? Isn't the line going through the interior where they need the gas? Especially an expensive one, that they could have some mechanism where they could take that LNG off in Fairbanks as they do with the pipeline there in North Pole at the refinery and distribute that to the interior. Because that's really, you know, we talk about gas in South Central, but that's really who needs gas right now. They're paying, you know, for heating fuel up there. Fairbanks was just listed as the most expensive major metropolitan city in the United States. So.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Sean Dugan, and Jill Burke. Let's get Jill in here. Jill, the Russian tanker on its way to provide fuel, we're sticking with that subject, to Nome, and presumably some relief and need of fuel, is turned back at least briefly. What's the latest on fueling Nome?
Well, that was just a very brief turnaround. It had to go back to Dutch Harbor to replace a faulty valve. That only took about 2 hours. They got right away underway again. And on Friday, Russian Christmas, which the crew is celebrating on board, we're told, they hit ice. So early Friday morning, the Healy and the Renda entered some portion of the ice pack at about a foot
depth. The Renda is the Russian vessel.
The Russian fuel tanker, yeah. Ice-breaking fuel tanker that's been specially commissioned to drive this fuel into Nome through the ice pack during the winter, which is a very unusual event. It's a fascinating event on many different levels, just the physical requirements of these vessels to drive themselves, you know, cut through the ice and get to Nome. In addition to all of the coordination that it took to get a foreign flagged vessel to be able to haul that load from one U.S. port to another, and the coordination of the U.S. Coast Guard escort, and this kind of commerce through a marine shipping course that's typically closed during the winter. It's a really interesting scenario that's unfolding, and they should arrive in Nome, we're told, by Monday morning.
And this has this aura of Nome during the gold rush. The last ship leaves and you're not on it, you're not going,
right.
And the ship that's going to bring the fresh vegetables, you can wait for them till next April.
Right.
Actually, it would be June, probably.
Right. So I think, they got caught off guard. Private fuel distributor up in Nome was awaiting a barge delivery that was coming in later than they had anticipated. They'd placed that fuel order early in the year last year, and it didn't show up. And when it was ready to drive itself to Nome, we had this horrible Bering Sea storm that came in and kind of screwed everything up. And that ship could no longer bring in the load because the ice had started to develop. And so the community is faced with, what do? We can fly it in. That's kind of the standard method in a pinch for Western Alaska and rural Alaska, but that increases the cost, that increases the frequency with which people have to actually handle the fuel. And the Native corporation that was purchasing this really felt that trying to figure out a barge delivery was the best option. And they happened to find this Russian vessel through an Anchorage shipping broker that could do the job. They hired the right equipment, and here we are.
Can I'm sorry.
No, I just,
go ahead.
One of the more enduring images I've seen throughout this whole thing is this massive coordination between Russia and the United States and Alaska and the Coast Guard and this ship and all this stuff. Rhonda McBride, reporter for Channel 2, interviews this guy in Anchorage earlier in the week, and in his office is a cardboard box with these valves and connectors. This thing doesn't work unless that box gets up to Nome so he can get the valves and connectors so they can transport the offload the fuel. It was just pretty funny, all these massive mechanisms and machinery and governments and things like that moving along, and there's this cardboard box, and it's got these different connectors in there that
right,
are
like
really integral to the whole operation.
It's like Jerry MacGyver meets, or is it MacGyver? I can't remember his first name, but MacGyver meets, the classic Alaska adventure tale through horrible wilderness and climate, and adaptation and ingenuity is ultimately what allows you to be successful.
It's a great story.
And is there some policy, peripheral policies here that are going to come into play? The governor has pushed for a road to resources, and one of those proposals is to Nome. The other one is that this is Russian ice-breaking tanker, because we don't have a lot of icebreakers. The Healy is our only one, and it's a medium class. It can't even go through the thickest ice. So, that puts a spotlight back on the lack of Arctic resources we have as an Arctic country and an Arctic state. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if this is going to come up later on in the year when they're talking about roads and
icebreakers. Sounds like the material of a Senate floor speech in Washington, wouldn't you think?
Somebody will have a picture of something, would imagine, on an easel there in the front of the Senate.
Just to reinforce that point, I think it's unknown. Right now we have this isolated one-time incident that everybody's kind of rallied around. The Native Corporation has said, we don't really want to do this again if we don't have to, but we could certainly see we're having a better Coast Guard presence in the Arctic, especially if we're developing offshore for oil and gas resources. Might be a smart thing for us to look into. Yeah. But in terms of commodities coming and going, the delivery of groceries and goods, they didn't really anticipate that would become a routine thing.
Does anyone here know roughly what fuel oil, home heating oil goes for in Nome?
They are currently at about $6 a gallon through Bonanza Fuel, which is the Native Corporation's fuel subsidiary. I don't know what they do have a competitor in town. I don't know what the competitor's charging.
Okay. Steve, we're going to go back to you. Bill Sheffield is out as port director with contract in hand. It may not have been particularly surprising that Governor Sheffield left as director of the port, but it is the conditions and the timing did surprise some people. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, he's the one who basically said, "I'm out." He's retiring. So so I guess you can say, "Oh, he called the shots." But there was certainly an awful lot of pressure mounting. There were quite a few folks who have been calling for his resignation, calling for him to be fired, simply because of the cost overruns with the port reconstruction. It's a project that was supposed to cost $360 million. It's now coming close to $1 billion. Mayor Sullivan got involved, said, okay, we're going to prioritize. We're just going to build certain segments of this project rather than the whole thing. Then there was the it seemed like a miscommunication where the mayor said, okay, we're only going to spend this much money to build this. And then Governor Sheffield said, well, no, we're going to go after the entire billion and finish the job at some particular point in time. So that caused a lot of controversy. So Bill Sheffield, he is now retired and he's out. And so I guess a lot of people who are critical of him are happy about that.
Well, okay. He's retired, but he's staying on
as
a consultant.
As a consultant, yeah, yeah. $60,000, yeah.
Why don't you tell us about that, Sean? I'm sorry.
Whomever.
One of you. Okay.
You know, $5,000 a month is more than most people make in a year. Yeah. So, you know, you wonder about the political move of removing Bill Sheffield and the lightning stone for all, or the touchstone for all this controversy. Mm-hmm. But then you keep him on board in this advisory capacity with this salary. And, you know, Mayor Sullivan points out that Bill Sheffield is a man of means. $60,000 isn't going to make or break him. So you got to wonder, why is Sheffield then still involved if the reason for him leaving was maybe to remove some of that controversy?
One of the reasons why, you talked about timing. Earlier in the week, a few days before he announced his resignation, he hosted a fundraiser for Mayor Sullivan.
He actually announced his resignation informally, shall we say, to that group, right?
Yeah. But you know, he's got a lot of allies, and it's not just the mayor, but he's on both sides of the aisle. He's a Democrat who's helped a lot of Republicans get elected to office. So it's politics.
Well, and then you have the mayor has said to us, to our journalists, that $350 million is all he's going to ask for. He believes that'll get us through the next 4 decades, and that anything further down the road be a decision for another mayor. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have Dan Coffey hired, former Assemblyman Dan Coffey and former chair, hired to go down to the legislature to do nothing but lobby for the port. So the legislature's already approved the $350. I guess some would ask the question, then, what do we need to have a dedicated lobbyist for the port if that's all the money they need from the legislature? So there's that.
And there'll be some version of Mr. Coffey, who's a very experienced public official and very knowledgeable about the system, will keep his eyes and ears open and keep us all informed about what needs to be done. And Sean, what are we told that Governor Sheffield's going to be doing?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure. He is going to be an advisor in some capacity of the port. Now, there is some value in that, I think, even from the most skeptical of people. I mean, the man has been involved with the port for many years. He's been involved in this situation of trying to get this expansion project done. He's aware of the problems in the past, so having him on board might be helpful. The big question I think most people have, though, is who's going to be the next port director? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean for the port? The mayor says he's working with the federal officials and the people in charge of the actual expansion project to get that back on track. How does this new person fit into that?
And it's pretty clear, I think, to all of us that Mayor Sullivan's opponents in the coming election, and particularly Paul Honeyman, are going to try and make whatever they can out of keeping Sheffield on.
Well, Honeyman was one of the first people to call for his resignation publicly.
Right, Okay, Jill, the stellar sea lion is back in court. A fierce battle between the state and the federal government continues about protected status for this venerable lion. You've been following this closely. Where are we now in the process of resolving the question about protected status for the sea lion, and where are we headed?
It's the question is before a federal court judge right now, and it really centers on the application of
and
the Endangered Species
judge?
Act
here,
in Anchorage, Anchorage U.S. District Court, Timothy Burgess. And basically, Fishing Coalition, the state of Alaska, and others have said that the federal government improperly applied standards under the Endangered Species Act to try to enact environmental change, rather than really looking at how well the sea lions might be doing, whether they've actually recovered, whether as a whole, not just in this western region on the Aleutian chain, they're doing better, and that there's really no true scientific proof that these fishing fleets, which I think are going for mackerel and cod, are competing unreasonably with the same food source that these sea lions are going after. And so they've kind of set it up as, look, this is a litmus test nationally for whether or not applications of the ESA, and by that I mean imposition of the standards and regulations under the Endangered Species Act, have overreached and overstepped their bounds, and whether we need to peel that back and have some type of changes or amendments congressionally so that these are more reasonable for resource-driven states, for fishing-type states, where people need to earn a living. And it's pitting the quality of life of the human beings in those same areas, meaning, can they make money? Can they earn cash? Can they, you know, support their families, against protecting this species that may not be on the brink of extinction, but is actually doing fairly well and kind of stable, but just not growing as much as we might have liked, or may not yet have attained the population goal for recovery. And they're saying, look, there's got to be some middle ground. Now, the regulators, the National Marine Fisheries Service, disagrees and believes that they've absolutely followed the law, they've followed the science, they've followed the directives. The fishermen want to fish. That's the big thing. They were given, they were told to not go out last year in two areas. That season opened again January 1st. I don't think they're fishing yet because I don't believe that that order has changed, but that's what they're asking for.
And this is where we see arguments over sound science, junk science, my science, your science, right?
Exactly, yeah. And what threshold is the right threshold, and you know, really what's the objective? Is the objective to use these kind of regulations that impact human industry to ensure that that species survive and, you know, meet a certain goal, or you know, so yeah, I'm getting twisted up here, but there's a lot of competing interests.
It's a twisted up subject.
It is a twisted up subject, and people feel very, very strongly about it. And it falls right into line with the state of Alaska, who believes that the federal government and its regulations, and in particular the Endangered Species Act, not just with Stellar Lions, but with potentially the Pacific walrus, the polar bear, critical habitat, beluga whales, is just out of control and really putting a damper on resource development and economic development that's crucial to the state.
Sean, let's go back to you here before we close out the show. You heard persistent rumors that Joe Miller might be making another appearance in a major role here in Alaska, but this role appears to be one that he says, no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, you know, it's very seldom in this business where you get to really squash something, especially like a persistent rumor. But we've been told, several of our reporters been told by, you know, several prominent lawmakers, that they believe that Joe Miller, the former senatorial candidate, is being considered by Governor Sean Parnell for the position of Attorney General. He is a lawyer. We actually called up Joe Miller. He answered the phone at his own home.
Where is his home now?
We called him. He was in Fairbanks.
Oh, really?
So
great.
We called him at the house, and he picked up the phone in Fairbanks, and we told him what he wanted. We told him who we were. He was very cordial, nothing but nice, and he did have quite a chuckle at the idea that he was being considered. So does that mean he's not? I guess you be the judge. I'm not willing to say anything's not going to happen, but it seems highly unlikely for a number of reasons, you know, especially would Governor Sean Parnell want to take on a hot potato like that at this point when he's got all this other stuff going on?
Before we close it out, Steve, what kind of a New Year's Eve did Anchorage have?
I know.
We had several people who were run over in a terrible car wreck, incident, I guess you could say. They were run over. We had numerous drunk driving arrests. And when I was downtown, as I mentioned earlier, I saw some broken glass.
Yeah.
How'd we do?
Well, and we also had dozens upon dozens of drunk drivers who were arrested by state troopers. They just put out stats yesterday. So quite a few crashes in their window of cracking down during the holiday period. I don't know how to compare it to years past. Of course, anytime you have people who are seriously injured in a what appears to be a drunk driving crash, that's very, very serious. You don't want to see that happen at all. So all our best wishes to the two folks who were injured, and hopefully they're improving.
Let's go to Sean, because I'm sorry. Sean, I know you've done a bunch of work on this particular case of the pedestrians who were run down and why there are no charges at the moment.
Clayton Wilbanks and I believe it's Ashley Brotherton are their names. Yeah. And Clayton Wilbanks had some serious injuries. Ashley was in critical condition. She's now speaking. We talked to Anchorage Police about this. Why wasn't the man accused, Tex Daniels, why hasn't he been arrested? And we were told flat out, if he'd hit a street sign, he would be in jail. Mm. But because there were serious injuries, they wanted to make sure that they got the charges right. And once they arrest him, they have 72 hours to charge him. And they have to send his blood out of state in a deal with the Homeland Security money that sends it to Washington. There's no motivation for them to get it done quickly. An example of this would be the young woman who was accused or is accused of running over Mr. Hubert Tunichuk on Easter Sunday. She was arrested December 6th.
Yeah.
Yes, and her name was Ashley Bashore. Okay. But it takes a while for these test results, whether it be DNA or whether it be blood evidence, to get out of Washington State. And you know, not for nothing, but if Mr. Daniels was, he's alleged to be driving drunk, he has not been charged, so he still has his license.
This has the aura of old Alaska, where you sent stuff outside by boat and waited for it to come back.
Real quick, nobody's more frustrated than the police officers, though, about this. So I think that this is something that we have to take up with this Department of Law.
And real quick, we're out of time. See you next week on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.